This is a continuation of Mr. Nigro's tape. This is tape two. So continue about your Portland or lab field.
Yeah.
So when the Russians left, then that essentially ended your job with
No. What took place then was the Air Force had instituted a rotation for people that had been in the service quite a few months. And in my case, I had been in the service 28 months, and then they were going to rotate me to Great Falls, Montana. And which they did, and so there again they put me on special duty. One thing about being on special duty was that the company that you were attached to, you did not eat with the company. You ate with the in the officer's mess. And so the money that was allotted for to feed me and the company, they gave to me as a like a bonus, like, you know, to go to be on special duty. And also the club, like here at Ladd Field, that they also gave me $30 more
to
run the club.
Run the club.
Yeah. So I had the equivalent of a little over $100, well, about $120. So one day I approached one of the officers and I said, you know, I said, don't you think it's time for me to give me a little couple of stripes? So anyway, they found out that I was earning more than a sergeant was earning.
So what was your rank at that time?
I was private first class.
Private first class.
Yeah, see? They said, look, Frank, they said, right now, you could never get it. I said, why? He says, you're earning more money than a sergeant is earning. He says, almost as much as a master sergeant. And he says, you're going to be turned down. Well, I said, okay. I said, the war is not going to last forever, you know. And I figured, well, that's all right. I'll sweat it out. And so, I was bartending over there in Great Falls, Montana. See, but on one of these trips, you know, they gave you leave. See, about once a year. So on one of these trips, they fly you from Ladd Field to Edmonton, through Whitehorse and Edmonton, and then there. Because I had to go, I wanted to see my folks back in Brooklyn. I had to take a train, a Great Northern train, from Edmonton to Minneapolis, and then from Minneapolis into New York, see? So the way it worked out is I had to lay overnight, or a couple of nights there in Edmonton. It was around New Year's time. There was a and so I went to the USO club there. They had a USO club, you know, where the servicemen went, both Canadian and American.
So this is in Edmonton.
Yeah. And so my wife...
I was going to say, I bet that's where you met your wife.
Yeah, my wife was with there with her brother, one brother and one sister. And they partook of the dancing and all that, so I asked her if she'd like to dance, and I said, sure. So I danced with her, and I talked to her, and I got acquainted with her, and I said, I'd like to take you home. And she said, well, she said, normally I go home with my brother and sister, you know, and introduce me to them, see? I said, sure, that's all right. I said, I'll walk with, all of us can go there. So anyway, they took me to where they were staying. And Anyway, in my coat pocket, I had a pint of Canadian Club. See, and I thought, well, I'll offer them a drink, and if they want a drink, you know. Mm-hmm. Sure enough, you know, we got some Canada Dry ginger ale, and we had a drink from the bottle. And then I had to go back to the base. Mm-hmm. So I left them, and I said to her, I said, would you mind if I wrote to you? She said, no. She said, I'd love to hear from you. I said, okay. So then on the way back, going back to the left field, I stopped in again at Edmonton. So I called up and I said, oh yeah, I said, come on over. So I went over and we chatted there for a while. And then, of course, I had to go back to the base there in Edmonton to catch the flight back to Fairbanks. So we got in touch with each other, you know. I kept riding back and forth. And the next time I had a trip there, I bought where I used to live. This lady asked me if I'd ever get a couple of dogs for her mm-hmm. in Edmonton. So I said, I'll look around when I'm there, you know. A couple of pups, you know. Mm. So I got them. I was able to get a couple of those.
Sled dog type? Or?
Those Chinese type of. Pekingese.
Pekingese, oh.
A couple of Pekingese, yeah.
Sled dogs in the north.
Right. Anyway, I bought them. Well, then I took them on the base. And now the job was to get them on the plane and to get them in the lad field. Mm-hmm. So the officer that was in charge, he says, no dogs are allowed. He says, I can't allow you to go back. Well, I said, I already bought them. I said, I promised this lady that I bought them for, that I would bring them up for her. He shook his head. He says, and I said to him, see what happened. They transferred this general. At that time, he wasn't a general. He was a colonel.
Oh, is it Gaffney?
Gaffney. Mm-hmm. They had transferred him from Fairbanks to Edmonton. See. Mm-hmm. So I said, I'd like to talk to the colonel. Well, I don't know if he was a major, if he was still a colonel, or whether he was a general then. At that time, I forgot. But anyway, I said, well, what do you want to talk to him for? And I said, I'd like to ask him if it's possible for me. I said, I know him. I said, I served him liquor at the bar. I served him drinks, you know, at the bar. And I said, if you tell him my name, I says, perhaps you'd already, he might allow an exception. So anyway, they got in touch with him and they told him who I was. So he told them to allow me to fly with them, see. And I knew another officer there that was in that, where I was sleeping. And he was one of the pilots that was ferrying one of those Russian planes mm-hmm. up there. And I said, could you make room for me in case they won't allow me on the VC-3 going back into Fairbanks? He said, mm-hmm. sure, I'll take you up there, fine.
With the dogs.
With the dogs, you know, of course, you know, says, I'll squeeze you in the plane somehow. So anyway, they came back and I said, yeah, I said, you can go. So I took the dogs here mm-hmm. and I gave them to that lady. They cost only $35 at that time, which was a decent price. Mm-hmm. So it was one male and one female.
Probably the only Pekingese in Fairbanks.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So anyway, she appreciated that very much, you know. So then, of course, I got transferred and down into Great Falls. And then pretty sometime, I think it was the 26th of October, because being in Alaska, at that time, they gave you, being a territory, they gave you extra points. Mm-hmm. They allowed you 2 points for each month that you...
You served in Alaska.
Yeah. And if you had accumulated 60 points, then you were eligible to get discharged. So I got a discharge from Great Falls, Montana. And so what happened was they allowed you so much mileage, gave you so much money for each mileage back to where you came from, mm-hmm. which was Fairbanks at that time. So, mm-hmm. so what I did was I took the train from Great Falls and went back home to see my folks again, see? Mm-hmm. Got discharged with the discharge. And then I called my wife up and I said, you know, I said, I would love to get married if you'll allow me to, you know. She says, okay, Frank. She says, I'll marry you. So I went back to Edmonton, took the train there, and we got married there in December the 4th. Mm-hmm. Same time, yeah.
Yeah, same time, or same day you went in.
That's right, yeah.
I noticed
that. That was a coincidence day, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I stayed with her until January, sometime in January, the early part of January, because I wanted to go back to work at the Nordale Hotel, mm-hmm. see?
So your job was waiting
job
for you.
Day, yeah, see? Because they had promised it that they would take back, you know,
anybody
soldiers, yeah. So that's what happened. I flew back, but she being still a Canadian citizen, she had to wait until she got clearance from Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
So she would be allowed to come to Fairbanks and because we were married. And
so you must have gotten back just in time for the fire. Wasn't there a fire?
Well, what took place there, was one evening I was working. Late that evening from 5 to midnight, that shift that I was working on. Mm-hmm. And this fire came about and it started there.
In that block?
Close to the theater. Do you remember the theater?
Are you talking about the
Second Avenue?
The co-op building or?
The co-op.
The Empress Theater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So same side of the street.
Yeah, and they were going to try to save that theater, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else burned in between.
Well, were things still wooden buildings for the most part at that point?
Yeah, they were all wooden.
So the
buildings. Wood
survive. But.
Yeah, uh-huh. And so what happened there was, well, there was not a chance. The temperature was in the minus 50 below zero at that time. And all the hoses froze up. There was maybe one or two hoses that it was just a piddling little water coming out that you couldn't help put the fire out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, everything burned down to the ground, see? And then, of course, the next day, one of the fellows who was working in a hotel, he had a room on the ground floor there. There was a liquor store behind one of them buildings. Mm-hmm. And with the amount of water that they had put in there, everything was encased in ice.
Mm-hmm.
All the liquor bottles and everything else. So he went the back side there. And he would scrounge. I'll put the word scrounge instead of stealing.
Salvage.
Salvage. Yeah, that's another good word.
Yeah, a lot of use.
Yeah. So anyway, he would take whatever he could, mm-hmm. walk down the street on Third Avenue, and go in the back entrance of Third Avenue. One of the entrances to the hotel. See.
Mm-hmm. It was on Third Avenue.
On Third Avenue, mm-hmm. and we had two entrances. You know. Because we had two wings there, see? Mm-hmm. And there were two wings. And he walked down the hall, go down into the basement, and there was a little room there, and he stacked up all that liquor down there, you know? And so one day, I was talking to him in the lobby, and I says to him, I forget his name, I says, what are you going to do with all that liquor? And he says, well, he says, maybe I could sell some. So I says, if I want to buy some, I said, what will you charge me? Oh, he says, to you, Frank, he says, give me a dollar. a bottle. So I bought many bottles from him for a dollar a piece. So then I was able to get an apartment, the Bowmeister Apartments, across the river there. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Over by Samson?
Yeah. You know, you cross the bridge, you know, mm-hmm. and over there, Garden Island.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see? And I had gotten an apartment there from Frieda and Max Bowmeister. Yeah. And they charged me $54 a month for that apartment, which was practically brand new because they had just built it and it was only about 2 years old. And they had 7 units there. So I had stacked all that liquor in the closet on the shelf there. So when my wife was finally able to come, why then I took her home, you know. And the first thing she did was open the closet to hang up her clothes. And she looked at all them bottles of liquor. And she, in her mind, she says to me, you know, I didn't think you drank quite a bit of liquor. She says, what's all that liquor? Well, I had to explain to her how I come about to get it, you know. And of course, I wasn't that much of a drinker either, you know. But anyway, that's how we all settled down.
Oh, goodness. So you worked at the Nordale for many years after that, then you were there most of your working life at the Nordale?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, see, then a couple of those clerks, they left. So Arnie Lee got to be the manager there.
Mm-hmm.
See, the other Block, Roy Block is the fellow that I knew, the previous manager.
Mm-hmm.
He had moved down to Seattle because his wife had opened up. They had opened up an office. Sears Roebuck had opened up an office across the street from the Nordale. See,
mm-hmm.
Well. She got transferred down to Seattle,
yeah.
So Roy went along with her,
mm-hmm.
and he went down there with her, see?
Mm-hmm.
And so Arnie Lee, who had been there,
moved up
with he was elevated to the managership.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lloyd Pike was also working there from Pike's Landing, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Lloyd Pike. And he was a clerk there, too. And so... somehow they squeezed me back in working the different shifts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one man would get a day off, I work his shift. Another man would get a day off, I work his shift. So I was the relief clerk. See?
The relief clerk.
Yeah. Until one or two of them quit. Roy, he quit. Lloyd Pike, he quit. And the people across the street, Fairbanks Hotel,
mm-hmm.
they hired him.
That's on the next street.
That's why he quit to be manager of their hotel over there, see?
Mm-hmm.
He thought that would be an exciting job for him, you know, mm-hmm. being manager,
yeah,
you know. Yeah.
And
then anyway, then later on, I got to be assistant manager
mm-hmm.
With Arnie Lee, see?
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed with that job there until the hotel burned down.
Yeah. Well, it's often said that the Nordale Hotel is the business and social hub of Fairbanks, or it was in those days. Who were some of the people that you remember that used to come in? And
we had
the whole town.
We had fur buyers come in, you know, who used mm-hmm. to buy fur, you know. And they would stay at the hotel, see, until they went out to these trading posts. In those days, they went out to the trading posts and to buy their fur,
mm-hmm.
mostly from the traders, you know, those trading posts.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like Johnny Schwegler now, for instance,
mm-hmm.
He would make many trips all over the country. That is, this part of this country, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't go down to the southeastern part because... the fur in the interior was much better
mm-hmm.
fur than the southeastern fur,
mm-hmm.
like mink.
Yeah.
He even taught me, Johnny Schwager taught me how to buy fur. when he was out of town, sometimes we'd get to somebody that wanted to sell their fur, you know, looking for Johnny Swigler. I would tell them, well, he's out of town. They said, I don't know when he's coming in. And they said, well, you know anybody else? Well, I said, maybe I'll buy the fur from you, you know, for Johnny Swigler, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I would buy the fur sometimes, but I got fooled. One night, two guys came in, and they had 34 mink that they had brought in, and they wanted a fur buyer. So I told them that Johnny was not in town. So I said, you want me to look at your fur? And he said, sure. Now you see, mink especially, they have, if the fur, if the animal is brought up in the interior, they acquire a longer hair, you know, mm-hmm. on the fur, see, mm-hmm. and a deeper
undercoat.
Yeah, yeah, you know,
because of the
yeah.
cold.
So, you know, it's funny, you know, I was going through all them skins, you know, and it never occurred to me that they were not local, you know, I mean, or from the interior.
Mm-hmm.
And so I quoted them the interior price, see, which at that time was $17 for each mink.
Mm-hmm.
And come to find out, though, that it wasn't, but I paid them.
Mm-hmm.
And when Johnny came in, I told him what had taken place. So I brought the mink down to his room, and he took one look. He says, Frank, he says, you made a mistake. I says, what do you mean? He says, these are not interior mink. And I says, why? And he had some mink in the room. And mm-hmm. he says, look at the difference. So I looked at both of them. Sure enough, yeah. you know, yeah.
Right, yeah. The ones you bought were shorter.
They, yeah, they yeah. came from the coast someplace, you know, around maybe Valdez or Cordova,
mm-hmm.
you know. Those places where it didn't get that cold, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, but he says, I'll send them to New York. He says, we'll see what we can get.
Mm-hmm.
And they quoted, anyway, they paid back $14.
It was a proposition.
But yeah, but he wasn't going to make up that difference, see.
Mm-hmm.
I had to make
you
up that difference.
Oh.
$3, three times.
Whatever.
Three times 34, you know, that was over
$100,
a little over $100. So I said to myself, okay, as long as that's the situation, I said, there'll be many guys coming in here. And sure enough, when he had left to go maybe take a trip down to Seattle, there was nobody there. So when these people would come in, Beaver or wherever it was, why, I would buy it, but I would sell it to a different fur trader, see?
Mm-hmm.
And I picked up a few dollars that way. I made up for the loss that I made on the mink, see?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, eventually, I didn't go into that business because a lot of them were poor natives, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They just try to make a scratch out of living, you know,
mm-hmm.
doing a little trapping, you know. Because times were still tough up there, you know. Yeah, you bet. Because there was no military camps, no nothing, you know, that they could go to. Because they would be down there by a fish wheel or somewhere, you know, and trying mm-hmm. to scratch out a living. Because it was still tough. But that's the way it worked out. Yeah.
Mm. Well, you must have known Eva McGowan quite well. Was she one of your long-standing tenants?
Very much. Yeah.
Was she living in the hotel in...
Yeah, she lived in room 207 on the second floor for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And the night of the fire, which took place, she had come in with some friends, and she went upstairs just about the time that the train came in. See, the train came in about 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And I took care of the crew at that time. They stayed at the hotel. At that time, Don Kirshner was also a clerk there at the Nordell.
Mm-hmm.
And he had come by that evening just to chew the fat. And he placed his gloves on the counter. And while we were talking, all of a sudden, somebody said, gee, we smell smoke. So I hadn't quite gotten ready to type in registration forms. And Don and I went out the side door through the office, and Don went around the lobby, and we went down the hall, and sure enough, we could see smoke in the hall.
This is about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night?
In about the center of the hall, a room was open, and there was a man standing on the outside of the room. And he was bare. He didn't have a stitch of clothes on him. And smoke was coming out of that room. So I went down there quickly, and I saw flames starting to pick up against the wall and from the floor. And I told Don, I said, we have to call the fire engines. But he went down the hall. We had one of those fire canisters, you know, hanging on the, on the hallway. So we grabbed that and tried to put the fire out ourselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we had no luck. It was, and I was stamping on the, I tried to stamp the fire out on the, that was on the floor, see.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, it was taking hold. But Anyway, got back to the switchboard and called the fire department right away, and we had already pulled the fire alarm, and all the the bells were ringing, you know, trying to get the people to know that there was a fire in the hotel, see. And I informed the fire department that there was a fire at the Nordale, and to come as quickly as possible. But anyway, they finally came, but in the meantime, got out of hand, you see. There was too much for them, because, you know, the building was built in 1923, and in those days, they didn't have the type of insulation that they have today, you know.
Or,
they had put sawdust in between the walls, you see, for insulation. And all that sawdust was all dried up, you know. So pretty soon the whole building was enveloped in flames. But I saw a couple of guys, when I went out the building myself, I just took my jacket that was in the back of the in the office, and I forgot my cap in there because there was nothing I could do. I had locked up the safe. I figured, well, if anything, you know, at least, you know, whatever records we had were in the safe. There was a lot of paintings in there, too, in the safe, that the hotel owned from various, you know, painters that we had here, Alaska painters. So, there was nothing else we could do. I saw a couple of people jump from the second floor building down, but I didn't see Eva McGowan, you know. But what took place there was that, you know, there was a lot of excitement, you know. You couldn't think of, you know, certain people, you know, that were in the hotel. You figure, well, the bell's ringing, you know, everybody would get out.
And then it was still early enough that most people would have been awake.
What took place there was, a man who was in the lobby, and he had been dispatched to go to work the following day up on the slope someplace. He was asleep in there, and I didn't know that. And there was another man, where was he now? Anyway, One of the train men had already gone upstairs and had been in the room, but he got out of the room too late. He made it out to the fire escapes on the Third Avenue side, and he was overcome by smoke right there by the window. Mm. They found his body there. And Eva McGowan, of course, she stayed in her room, evidently, you know, and she went with the fire. But four people totally had perished in that mm-hmm. fire. Mm-hmm. There was another lady that was on the second floor. She also perished in the fire. And it's a funny thing. That lady called me upstairs on a Sunday. I worked the day shift on Sunday. She called me upstairs and told me that there was water running in her room. She was a native woman. And she said, "I can hear water." So I went up there to check to see perhaps there was maybe water running from the third floor down into the second floor, see? And I could hear nothing. But anyway, I told her, I said, "I don't hear nothing, you know, but maybe it was a premonition or whatever it was, you know, for her, that there's something that's going to take place." But she didn't make it.
So she was one of the fatalities?
She also said,
See, that was in February, wasn't it?
February the 22nd.
1972. That's what I thought, yeah. 21 years already. Now, it was end of an era. It was a hotel that they say was a social and business hub for so long. That you can think of all kinds of people.
All kinds of people. We had sample rooms in the basement for the salesmen that came mm-hmm. with samples. We rented them one of the sample rooms downstairs. And it was very accommodating to those people that were traveling, those salesmen, you know. Plus, of course, all the people that were going from Fairbanks to other interior cities like Nome or Kotzebue
Did you have a lot of dignitaries come through and stay there?
Oh, yes.
Anybody in particular that comes to mind?
Yeah, the governor coming in. Governor Reagan stayed there, for one. And Governor... what's his name? Territorial governor.
Oh, Stepanovich? Oh, no, he was here. The Greening? Greening? Greening?
Yeah, Greening.
Greening.
Governor Greening, yeah.
President Harding?
Who?
President Harding?
President Harding, he came also in 1923. They tried to finish that that hotel up before he came. And when President Harding came, they gave him a room in the front. And in fact, they even had a registration card there that they kept in the vault. Yeah, and they just... See, the Nordale Hotel originally was located on First Avenue, close to where that USO building is there. Mm-hmm. And that burned down there, see? And then they rebuilt on Second Avenue. They had that lot there, so they rebuilt there.
Oh, I see. So that's the picture of this building on Second Avenue, the second Nordale Hotel.
Yeah, but like I said, this grocery business was not there at that time.
Not when you were there. So this predates the time you came in.
Yeah.
Maybe. Well, thank you very much for consenting to be interviewed. Yeah. Interesting hearing your stories of Alaska and your recollections of a very important part of Alaska history.
Yeah.
Thank you. And
you're welcome.